This is In Conversation from Apple News. I'm Shamita Basu. Today, former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi on what Democrats need to do to win the White House. On March 20th of 2010, the Catholic priest, Father Theodore Hesburgh, got a phone call from a high-ranking politician, someone of deep faith herself.
I said, "Father, I have to admit we're having some difficulty with some of the bishops who refuse to accept the fact that we do not have funding for abortion in this bill."
It was then Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, whose voice you just heard. She was trying to get the Affordable Care Act passed through Congress, and she was having trouble convincing a few Democratic members to give it their vote. Father Hesburgh was the president of the University of Notre Dame for 35 years, a leader in the civil rights movement, and someone who could have an influence on lawmakers who respected him but had reservations about the ACA. So Pelosi said to him,
"I need some help with Congressman Joe Donnelly."
Father Hesburgh replied,
"Well, give me his number." And he called him, "Speaker and I need you to vote for the Affordable Care Act."
The day after that phone call, Congressman Donnelly voted for the ACA, which passed the House. President Obama signed it into law 2 days later. Father Hesburgh wasn't the only one Pelosi called in a favor to. She even overheard Congressman Donnelly talking with other members of Congress about how she convinced them to vote for it.
And I hear them preparing notes. But then he said, "You should see what she did to me. She had Father Hesburgh. It's like the Pope was calling me. What was I supposed to do?"
This is the power of former Speaker Nancy Pelosi. It's what makes her such a skilled politician. She knows how to bring people to her side, even if it means sending a different messenger. Pelosi was first elected to Congress when she was 47 years old, nearly four decades ago. She served as Speaker of the House twice, from 2007 to 2011, and again from 2019 to 2023. Even though she's no longer the official leader of House Democrats, it's clear that she still wields enormous power within the party. She's most recently been credited with convincing President Biden not to seek re-election, though you'll hear how reluctant she is to state that plainly. And now she's out with a new book, The Art of Power, reflecting on her time as the first woman speaker. I got a chance to sit down with Speaker Pelosi and ask her how she found herself holding one of the most influential jobs in American politics.
I was born into a political family, mm-hmm. So I was always impressed that public service was a noble calling. And so when my children were old enough, were in school, I took a major role in volunteering in the Democratic Party to the point that I became the chairman of the party, which for me was a great honor. Then people came to me and asked me if I would run. I had never had any ambition to run, never even wanted to run. I was like, "Why are you asking me? I've never shown any interest in this." "Well, we thought you would be good." We had five children in 6 years and 7 days, and four of them were already away at college. One was going into senior year of high school. She was 16, young for class. But I said, "Alexandra, Mommy has been asked to run for Congress, and I won't even give it a thought if you don't think I should do it." I'd be gone like three nights a week. And she said, "Mother, get a life." I never heard that expression before. This is a long time ago. "Get a life." What teenage girl wouldn't want her mother out of the house three nights a week? So there we are.
Now, for so many years of your career, you have been just one of a handful of women at top leadership. How did you think about navigating that as a woman? And how did that experience change over the years?
Well, when I first went to Congress, there were 23 women out of 435 members. Mm. It was a novelty. It was a rarity to have women in Congress. Then as time went by and our numbers grew, when I was called upon to run for leadership, they said, "Who said she could run?" And I said, "You know what?"
"Who said that?"
"The men, yeah." Mm. "Who said she could run?" And I said, "Why don't you light my fire? I mean, you were really urging me on, if you don't know it." Also, they said, "Well, if the women have some concerns, why don't we just write them on a paper and then give them to us and we'll get that done for you?" Nah, poor babies. Why would they think that? And then they said things like, "Men have been waiting for certain positions here for a while, and you are breaking in the line. I said, no, we've been waiting for over 200 years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we're breaking in the line. But anyway, as we see with Kamala, and I'm so excited about her candidacy, certain thresholds have been crossed. Certain marble ceilings are broken in case of me becoming the speaker, but now with our anticipation that we will elect her president of the United States. But she's not running to elect a woman, as I did not. I said, don't vote for me because I'm a woman, or don't vote against me because I'm a woman. Just judge my credentials and what it means to our caucus, in this case, hers, to what it means to our country.
I do want to talk much more about Kamala Harris in just a bit. Let's turn to your book. The mm-hmm. title is The Art of Power.
Right.
The book takes us into a few major moments in your political yeah. career. You've talked about this, how you were quite literally the woman in the room where it
mm-hmm.
happened.
Yeah.
I wonder if you could tell our listeners some of the stories that you write about here that sort of demystify how Washington works. And I thought maybe we could take the example of the Affordable Care Act section
yeah.
of the book. I know that is also something that you're very proud of as part of
I
your
mm-hmm.
accomplishments.
For 100 years, presidents have tried to make progress on expanding the universe of people who have access to affordable health care. Starting with Teddy Roosevelt, the presidents have all wanted to do that. President Truman fought so much for Medicare and the rest, so that when LBJ finally got Medicare passed, he went to Independence, Missouri to sign the bill in the presence of President Truman. And as you know, the Clintons tried very hard. They made it a priority, but it did not prevail. So President Obama comes in with his vision of expanding opportunity, lowering cost, and all the different aspects of it, improving benefits and the rest. And that was a vision that was shared by the Democrats in the Congress. I would like to have thought it would have been bipartisan, but they just weren't going to go there, sadly.
Right.
But
and when you read, I'll just say, when you read the chapter, I mean, you appreciate the many, many steps and steps forward and a few steps back mm-hmm. that something goes through in this process. I mean, this is not the Schoolhouse Rock version of how a bill becomes a law. It's not as linear as that. And it's clear that the skill that you have that's on display here is you know how to convince people to see what is in their best interest in a piece of legislation.
Well, the thing is it's not just about convincing them of the point of view. It's listening to them and hearing their concerns, because some of their concerns were maybe not well-founded, but some were. And so there were differences regionally,
mm-hmm.
philosophically, and they had to be listened to. Where do we find our common ground? And it's the beauty of legislating, and most people don't realize, they think, oh, you got a bill, you write a bill and you just pass it. No, it's a collaboration. And that takes me to the point that I want to make, is outside mobilization is so important to any legislative success. We can do our inside maneuvering, but the public sentiment is, that's what Lincoln said, public sentiment is everything. With it, you can accomplish almost anything. Without it, practically nothing.
Hmm.
We had a fight for the public sentiment because the other side was putting out misrepresentations, but we were able to pass the bill and save the bill from what they were trying to do.
Well, let me ask you what you're saying about public sentiment, because I was so surprised reading in this chapter about how, you know, you write about how Republicans were leading this very pointed campaign of messaging about what was in the bill and spreading falsehoods about what was in the bill. And at the time, Democrats asked President Obama for $9 million to counter that messaging, and he said no.
Well, he did say no. His folks said no.
Sure.
President Obama was always there for us, but his folks decided that they just ignored the request, really. I don't even know if they said no or they just didn't do it.
Well, why not invest in counter-messaging? As you're saying, public sentiment is so important to do. And I feel like, I mean, this is kind of a criticism more broadly of the Democratic Party. There have been many instances in which the messaging has just mm-hmm. not reached people in a clear way. And Republicans are very successful at messaging in the way that they want to.
Well, they're successful because they have one message. We're not a lockstep party. Mm-hmm. We're just not that. And I would not want it to ever been the leader of a party that was a lockstep party. This is a Democratic Party. It has different points of view. But your point is well taken. Say, for example, right now, President Biden has been a transformational president. He has been consequential in historic terms as a president of the United States. 15 million jobs created in the first 2 years of his term. The other guy, the worst record of job creation of any president since Herbert Hoover.
Under President Trump.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What's his name? Now, they take polls and they say, oh, I felt more economically secure under Trump. Why? Well, because we haven't messaged it properly. So we have to do a better job in that regard. But we tell the truth. And that's more challenging than just going out there and saying whatever you feel like saying, even though it has no validity in fact or values or anything else. So that's what this election will be about. It's about, at some point, just about how the message goes out there and who carries it and what the language is of it. And that's why our grassroots operation will prevail in this election. We'll own the ground to get out the vote. But the messaging part is very important.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this about President Biden. You recently demonstrated your power when, at least as media reports it, you got Biden to step aside and not seek re-election. Now, Biden once said, if the Lord Almighty told me to step down, maybe I would. And I have seen the joke. I guess that means that Nancy Pelosi is the Lord Almighty. I don't know if you've heard that one. But I've heard you in a few interviews now kind of deflect questions about what happened behind the scenes. But I want to press you on this and just ask, why not say more?
Well, the president made his own decision. Some in the press were saying I was burning up the phone lines, calling people. But I didn't call one person. I didn't even call him, but the press said I called him. Hmm. But I did speak with him. A conversation with the president is a confidential matter, by and large, especially when it involves his decision-making in such an important way. So there will come a time for that. But right now, the point is, I stayed in Congress to help win the Congress for the Democrats and to make sure that we would elect a Democratic president. I see, I'll use his name now, Donald Trump, as a menace to our democracy. I see him a person of no integrity, no values, no vision for the future. All I was pleading for was a stronger campaign because I did not see a campaign that could prevail against his misrepresentations, his endless money, and that could have an impact on the House and Senate. The House has always long been my responsibility, so I'm determined that we will win the House. Hakeem Jeffries will become Speaker of the House. But we needed a bigger, stronger campaign coming at the presidential level. The president made the decision that that would happen by his stepping aside.
But you said you did speak with him. Did he seek your counsel, your advice on what to do?
I don't know that I would say he sought it, but in any event, I love the president. He's been my friend for over 40 years.
Well, let me ask you this. Now that the energy has really shifted, I think many Democrats would like to leave the sort of chaotic, unsure chapter behind the immediacy of what things were like right when Biden announced he wouldn't seek re-election. But the fact is the party was in serious trouble just before Biden's announcement. Biden made his decision. And it's easy to celebrate the change in energy now. But can you speak to what went so wrong to land the Democrats in that position in the first place of trying to convince a poor polling president to step aside?
Well, I don't think that that's trouble. I think we're the Democratic Party. I see that as a strength. I completely disagree with your characterization of it with all due respect.
Of course. No,
I think that's the strength of the party, where we have different points of view and we work through them. As I said, we're not a monolithic party. We're not a lockstep party. Our party is 70%, and this I take great pride in, 70% women, people of color, LGBTQ. 70%. To say that about a congressional party is remarkable, the beautiful diversity of it. It's diverse in those ways, but it's also diverse generationally, geographically. But I think our party's great. So we have new leadership. They're going to take over the House. I'm quite certain of that in a matter of 90 days or whatever is left here. Mm-hmm. And they put people over politics, and that's who they are. So I don't agree with that characterization. I think disagreement is a sign of strength, not of weakness.
If President Harris were to win, she would, of course, be the first woman president of the United States. I know that you are close with Hillary Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
What lessons do you think Harris can take from Clinton's failings in 2016?
Well, I wouldn't call Clinton's failings. Let me just say, as I answer that, Hillary Clinton was the best prepared person in a generation to run for president. We had never seen a presidential election where somebody would come in and be such a disaster as Donald Trump. So people didn't anticipate that. And so it's not the failings of Hillary Clinton. It's the kind of campaign he put on that gave the impression that he would be better than he was. But he was, from the start, horrible. But nonetheless, we know who he is now.
We know who he is now, and plenty of Americans want him to be back in office.
Well, it's, I think, a couple of things. First of all, I think there's a segment that are just negative about women, about LGBTQ, about newcomers, about diversity. They like it the way it used to be. Make America great again might as well be make America white again. You know, that's just the way it is. But there are legitimate people in the electorate who have concerns that have to be respected. They have concerns about their future economically. They're concerned about globalization. They saw the factory down the road leave and go to another country. They're concerned about innovation. What happens to my job if with innovation? They're concerned about immigration, which is less threatening to their jobs, but some of them don't see it that way. And then they see, you know, women, LGBT women coming in. And what does it mean for me and my family in this new kind of an economy? The more we can convey that to them, that there's a place for them in the future that is respected, I think that is part of the challenge, is to get the message to those folks. There have always been cultural issues overriding it. The three G's, gays, God, that would be the so-called abortion issue, they call it God, and guns.
Guns.
Mm-hmm. And everything is an opportunity. This is an election of opportunity for us to show the real contrast between the Democrats and the Republicans. And I say that with respect for so many Republicans that I have worked with. I keep saying to them, take back your party. This isn't who you are. The grand old party doing so much for our country and with great leaders in our country. And now, toadies to the sky. Hmm. What's happened to you? The country needs a strong Republican Party. It does not need a cult to somebody like Donald Trump.
Can I ask you something? I mean, to go back to the issue of abortion for a moment.
Yeah.
This is something that really frustrates me, I'll just say, as a voter, when I hear politicians say, after the election, we'll do this. I'll do that. We'll codify abortion rights as federal law. For politicians who are currently in office, I always want to ask, like, why should I believe a promise for later if you didn't get it done in the past? I think people are feeling that way about certain issues. Abortion is one of them.
Well, we passed it in the House over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
The Senate has a archaic rule, 60-vote rule. Pull back the filibuster, then you could do these things. It would be background checks for guns. It would be Equality Act for equality for LGBT community, or it'd be raising the minimum wage, or so many things. So your question is very well founded, not just for Roe v. Wade, but for background checks, on for the immigration bill, for Equality Act. There's a whole list of things.
Let's talk about age.
Mm-hmm.
You are 84 years old yourself.
Mm-hmm.
President Biden is 81. Do you think that there should...
Donald Trump is 78.
Yes.
While we're leading him out of this conversation.
No, correct. Okay. Correct.
Yeah.
Do you think there should be an age where we ask elected officials, people running for office, even Supreme Court justices to step down?
No, I don't think so. I think age is a relative thing. If I thought that, I wouldn't be running. And I'm running to make sure Donald Trump does not get to be president of the United States. I think it's relative. I think being Italian gives me a lot of energy. Eating dark chocolate every day does too. But I feel very energetic. But I'm not here because I don't have alternatives. I'm here because I don't want Donald Trump to become president of the United States, and I want the Democrats to take back the Congress. That's why I ran again. Mm-hmm. Now, I think there should be term limits for Congress. No, because that is a lobbyist bonanza plan. We'll just wait you out. You got an issue? You're fighting for this, that, or the other thing? We'll just wait you out.
Mm.
So I don't think that's a good idea at all. We have to run for office, and our constituents can accept or reject us. Age is a relative thing. They can make a decision as to whether we're worth the trouble or not. I do think there should be term limits on the Supreme Court, because why should somebody have a job for life with such power and not have to be accountable to the public?
The United States is a real outlier when it comes to the Supreme Court lifetime appointments.
Yeah, lifetime appointment. Now, as I say, the Supreme Court is rogue, in my view. So I do think there should be term limits, and there should be an ethical standard, which they just simply will not accept.
Mm, so it sounds like you agree with these recent proposals that President Biden made.
Oh, yes. I think President Biden was right on point. So it doesn't mean that any one party would have an advantage if there were term limits.
Mm. You've talked about how this book is really about your legacy, what you're most proud of, what you're leaving behind for the next generation of political leaders. What do you feel your legacy is? What do you want it to be?
Well, this is not the sum total of my legacy. I will write another book about that. I've got to write about climate. I've got to write about Ukraine. There are many other things. Mm-hmm. That is not the sum total of my legacy. Mm-hmm. And Congress, says she immodestly. But any success I may have had isn't about me. It's about the courage of our members. And I always say it's about the courage of the members, the inside maneuvering, the outside mobilization makes all the difference. So it's how you bring all of that together. This is what I say to people right now. We have to put one good day in front of another. We have no wasted time, no underutilized resources, and no regrets the day after the election that we could have done just a little bit more. We have made a decision to win. Important other decisions have been made in furtherance of that victory. And we just have to get the job done now for the children.
Madam Speaker, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure to be here.
I really appreciate it. You can read Speaker Nancy Pelosi's new book, The Art of Power, on Apple Books. We'll include a link for you on our show notes page.